stance. The dice roll every random chance. Take off your coat and stay a while. We'll roll in that D percentile.
Hi, Dave. It's Arlen Walker. I had sort of two comments based on your episode of Taxonomy of Player Skill. And the first one is that I think that tactical play is overvalued among certain groups, specifically because, in my opinion, tactical play is very much a heuristic or essentially a flowchart. It's basically saying, when do I check for traps versus when do I push on because I'm worried about random rolls versus when do I do all that sort of stuff. And in particular, I think there are much more tactically intensive games than D&D itself that you can totally play with a flowchart. Now, the flowchart player doesn't often win because there's still space for inventive tactics and things like that. But you can play solo versus a flowchart in games like Lock and Load Tactical or Advanced Squad Leader, these hex and shit war games that you can totally play solo with a flowchart player as the opponent. And the flowchart player plays pretty well, sometimes better than the human player because they don't make silly mistakes sometimes. So that, to me, tactical play really is sort of a comparison of who has the best flowchart, especially over the long term. It's in my opinion, it's basically who has the best heuristics that they're playing from, which is a skill. It's a skill to design something like that and to have the best flowchart. But in my opinion, it's sort of an artifact of the way that the game's history, that the flowcharts aren't shared at all. Nobody seems to have like written up, okay, here's the sort of gameplay loop of fighting through a dungeon. Here's the considerations that you should be taking into play. Here's all of the different things that your flowchart should involve, except in the some of the DMGs, and they're totally DM-sided, in my opinion. But that for the player side, it's been essentially more, to my mind, lack of official support that causes that problem than it is anything else. But I digress. The other thing that I wanted to say is that the discussion about player skill sometimes rankles me because it is so often or almost entirely unaccompanied by a discussion of GM skill. And I think that's a important consideration when you're talking about those sorts of situations, those what I would describe as the sort of edge cases in regard to normal play, right? If most play is the adventurer's hale and hearty and kicking ass in the dungeon, what happens when somebody goes down or some, you know, trap is triggered or something like that? Those cases, I think sometimes it is, you know, players not playing tactically enough, but there's a real place for GM skill, I think, that is not recognized sometimes. And it kind of annoys me that the people who say something like, well, I don't kill the players kill themselves, sometimes seem totally unwilling to engage with the possibility that maybe it's their GMing that's at fault and not the player's lack of tact. Anyway, that's kind of my thoughts, that tactical play is really about who has the best decision-making heuristic and who can stick to it, especially when things go south and it's tempting to start to change your tactics or change your tactics when that's absolutely necessary. And simultaneously, that the discussion of player skill ought to be supplemented by a discussion of GM skill, and that's one of the things that kind of annoys me about a lot of the discussion about kind of player skill, is that it doesn't seem to be accompanied by discussion of GM skill or things like that. And that's sort of, you know, I think most GMs, especially who have been doing it for a long time, think that they're pretty good, and they probably are pretty good, but you can always learn more. So that's just my thoughts on the subject. Hey, Dave, it's Arlen again. Just listened to the Real World Expertise episode and thought I'd chime in. I agree with a lot of the stuff that you said, particularly, I think, to put it in other terms. I am of the opinion that real world expertise is a great feature of game design, but not necessarily of actual play, if that makes sense. That I really like a lot of the games that I've seen where it's clear that whoever designed the game had a real sense of how whatever they're trying to model in the game actually works, and therefore are able to, I think, construct a really... often it is both, in my opinion, fun from a simulationist perspective and from a gamist perspective, particularly just because... So one example that I'm thinking of is the Riddle of Steel and the various riddle-likes, all of which are based, at least in part, on real experience with sword fighting, as close as you can get to real sword fighting today. Obviously, it's not the same as a knight training for years and years and then going out onto the battlefield and doing their thing, but you can get pretty close. And I think combat in those games is extremely engaging and fun because, in part, because it is designed from that perspective of real world expertise, that there's a lot of real thought that went into how does this actually work in a way that, for instance, I think most versions of D&D do not have at all, especially with regard to combat, that it's pretty clear. Well, just that combat in D&D, in my opinion, doesn't resemble what we know about kind of realistic or simulationist combat in a lot of ways for the period, and that there's a lot of kind of interesting things that you could do with combat that aren't done in D&D because of some of the assumptions that are made, in my opinion. But that's sort of another feature. At the same time, I think that player expertise in play, in my opinion, it's good when it is supplemental, not when it's required. When somebody pipes up during play with like, oh, I know about this sort of thing, and we can add to the world, add to the shared story, add to what's going on in the game. Like when, for instance, somebody like you with a background in philosophy might be able to have a sort of insight into the nature of a culture or an ethos or something like that that didn't occur to anybody else but could enhance the game in a number of ways because of its similarities with real-world philosophy. I think that's really cool. I think the problem is when it becomes required and is not treated as something supplemental. And especially my go-to example for this is charisma-based checks. I know there are a lot of old grognards out there who just hate the idea of people, you know, rolling persuasion to get what they want off a character sheet and not having to make an argument. I personally think it's ridiculous to say that Jack, who is a fighter, doesn't need to know anything about fighting, but my high intelligence and high charisma bard, whose job is to talk to people, I have to figure out how to come up with all sorts of arguments and convincing things in order to actually play that character, right? That irks me to no end, the idea of charisma-based characters, I think, being treated very differently than characters who specialize in other things, especially in a world where, you know, wizards don't, you know, players playing wizards don't have to know how magic works. It's not like they have to have a background in magical theory to say like, oh, this is the nature of magic in the world. I already used the example of fighters. Rogues in most systems don't, or thieves, it's not like they have to say, oh, this is how I'm going to try to disarm this specific trap. It's, you know, something that you roll. I think it's really silly that there's that distinction made between the different fields of expertise in that way. It irks me in play a lot. And it also, I think, so in my opinion, a GM who gets told, I just want to roll persuasion, I don't want to talk through this thing, is being told, A, what the player actually wants out of the game, and B, might be being told that their attempts at the GM's attempts to create a functional world and all of that sort of stuff are not going over as well as they think they are. That, in my opinion, that's just sort of me, but if I'm a player and I say, I just want to roll persuasion, I don't want to have to talk through this thing, that's a chance for a GM, going back to what I said before about GM skill in the previous set of call-ins, to me, that's a real, that ought to be a big red flag that the GM is either has differing expectations for the game, or perhaps just isn't fulfilling the shared expectations as well as they think they are. Because if I'm running a game and I expect players to sort of talk through their arguments and that sort of stuff, and a player says, I don't want to do that, that to me says a lot more about the history of how those arguments have gone, and that basically it's a, like I said, it should be a red flag. And I think sometimes the grognardy types get set in their ways. And in the same way that GMs won't stop and think about, is GM skill a factor in this TPK and not just player skill, that they'll go, well, of course, this is the way we've always done it. Of course, charisma isn't just a magical skill you roll to convince people. And I think, yeah, but combat is basically like that, and magic is basically like that, and trap finding is basically like that, and all this other stuff is basically like that. I don't know. It's just something that it bothers me in game when it comes up. So I thought I would use that as an obvious example, because it really is a piece of real world expertise to be able to craft a quality argument that is going to alter a person's opinion or something like that. So anyway, that's just me on player expertise.
Thanks, Arlen. So good to have another epic long Arlen call in after a little while. You want to check out Live from Pelham's Wasteland? Lots of similarly wise and thoughtful insights on there, Arlen's podcast. It speaks for itself. I am going to pick up on that last point, yeah, about persuasion. I'm absolutely with you. I've talked about this before. I actually shared a little, well, sort of mini game or subsystem that I developed for the Black Hack for having theological debate. It was just a bit of fun. People know that I've got inclinations in that direction. And we used it in my Black Hack game for there is a couple of, you know, plots involving the clerics or characters that were following things up with temples. And it just seemed fun to have a system in there for theological debate. And I shared these rules. They're on my blog. I've included the link. I shared them on a couple of old school communities. And I got rounded on a couple of times by people saying, this is not old school play. This is not what we do. And I think maybe Matt Finch made a claim to that effect in his primer. But I kind of think, you know, Matt Finch can play his games how he wants and other people can play games other ways. You know, I think the suggestion was that in old school games, anything you can play through by talking out, you don't need rules for. You just talk it out and it's all in the role play. And I agree with you that this is an arbitrary distinction. You know, we don't expect people to play out the combats. We leave that to the rules. Yes, we encourage people to narrate things in interesting ways. And this was exactly how my theological debate subsystem worked. It didn't get rid of the role playing. You know, the players were free and encouraged and did, in very entertaining ways, discuss their various rhetorical gambits. But then it was fun to let the effects of the persuasion play out in accordance with the roll of the dice and, of course, the particular skills and you know, mechanical advantages of particular classes. It made sense that certain attributes or certain concepts would mean that your character would be more successful in attempts at rhetorical persuasion than others, regardless of the player's own particular skill. And it is a skill. I mean, being able to extemporize moves in theological debate is a pretty rare skill, really. It was, of course, done in the game in all sorts of interesting and entertaining ways. But, of course, you know, they were more entertaining for that they were colourful and illustrative rather than particularly because they were, you know, damning moves in philosophical arguments. So I'm absolutely with you. I don't, you know, Matt Finch has done a lot, of course, for the OSR, but I don't think we have to accept that distinction that he, I think, and others make, you know, combat, mechanical, speech, always to be role-played. Yeah, thanks for those thoughts, Alan. And I've discussed this before on the show, actually, just as an addendum, but it doesn't hurt to say it again, that, of course, if you pour through the earliest editions of Dungeons and Dragons, you will see, of course, that there are these mechanical subsystems for things that you could be looking after with respect to the, you know, to the real world charisma and persuasive power of the players. Because, of course, your charisma bonus does modify reaction rolls. So that rule isn't strictly true. You could leave any effect of you know, the conciliatory attempts of the players, you could leave that all down to the role play, but those earlier systems don't. They allow that mechanical element to spill over into those rules. So actually that charisma modifier becomes not so different from your bonuses to attack in combat, which are, of course, independent from any particular awareness you might have of real life martial arts or fencing techniques and so on.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to contact Dave, please leave a message on Anchor, email dpercentile@gmail.com, or find him on Twitter @d_percentile.